Hello everyone, welcome back to our Strong Gravity seminar this week. It's a pleasure to have Anna Christina Eilers from MIT with us today. Anna Christina obtained her PhD from the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Heidelberg in 2019, and she's now a NASA Hubble Fellow at MIT, interested in the formation and growth of supermassive black holes, as well as the evolution of sort of galaxies and quasars in the early universe, which is exactly what we'll hear about today. So, Christina, please take it away. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me. My name is Christina Eilers. I'm a postdoc at MIT since about a year now. And I'd like to show you some of my research on the formation and growth of supermassive black holes with an emphasis on the very early universe. So within the first billion years or so of our cosmic history. We know that black holes exist in various sizes. So for instance, if a star at the end of its lifetime undergoes a core collapse supernova, what remains is a black hole with a few solar masses and size. And then since a few years, we all know from the gravitational wave detectors, LIGO and Virgo, that there are these more massive black holes of order like 10 to 100 solar masses, which also likely have stellar origin, but they might have undergone a few mergers, for instance, in dense stellar clusters or so, to become more massive. Then there are so-called intermediate mass black holes between like 100 to about 10,000 solar masses. They have been postulated that they should exist, and there are a few tentative detections, but it has, I think, not yet been conclusively proven that they actually exist, but the center of globular clusters, for instance, are very likely candidates to host such intermediate mass black holes. And then there are the supermassive black holes with million to several billions of solar masses in size, and they reside in the center of massive galaxies. And you've probably all seen this one here. It's the center of M87, of course, which has recently been imaged for the first time by the Event Horizon Telescope and is about 4 billion solar masses in size. And in this talk, I'm going to focus on these most massive black holes that we know in the universe. And we actually observe these supermassive black holes ubiquitously in the center of massive galaxies in the local universe. So in every massive galaxy lurks one of these black holes that are many millions to billions of solar masses in size. And the one in the center of our own galaxy, the Milky Way, is actually fairly small, with just about 4 million solar masses. And so how do these black holes become so massive? Well, they have to accrete matter from their surroundings, like gas and stars and dust and smaller black holes. And this accretion process is very efficient, which makes these actively accreting black holes, so-called active galactic nuclei, AGN, incredibly luminous. And the most luminous of these AGN are so-called quasars. And you can see here one on the bottom right, where we have very luminous emission coming from the center of the accretion disk around the black hole. And then we have these jets. We see these jets coming out perpendicular to the accretion disk, which is usually a sign of nuclear activity. And we think that most of the black hole growth happens while a galaxy is in this active luminous quasar phase. And so we assume that every massive galaxy underwent a luminous quasar phase in the past that produces these supermassive black holes that we observe ubiquitously in the center of all galaxies in the local universe. Another way to phrase this is the so-called Soltarn argument, which states that the integrated emission from quasars over cosmic time is proportional to the total mass and supermassive black holes today. And so this argument provides a link between these distant quasar progenitors and the relic quiescent supermassive black holes that we observe in galaxies locally. So when we find a supermassive black hole today, we know that the galaxy underwent one or multiple luminous quasar phases in the course of the universe. And that's fine, there's easily enough time to grow the black hole. But what challenges this very simple picture is that we observe these quasars also in the very early universe, when the universe is less than a billion years old. And so you've all seen this picture before. In our standard cosmological picture, we assume that the universe started about 13.8 billion years ago with the Big Bang, it underwent a phase of rapid expansion called inflation until it had expanded and cooled down enough until protons and electrons could combine to form neutral hydrogen. The universe became transparent, the cosmic microwave background was released, and what followed was a period that is known as the cosmic dark ages, where there's no sources of visible light until the first stars and galaxies formed. And these sources emit ionizing radiation, which start to reionize, or actually ionize for the first time, the intergalactic gas, which is mostly hydrogen, and the so-called, the intergalactic medium. And so the universe transitions from this neutral state to a mostly ionized state in which that we observe today. And this period is called the epoch of reionization. There's still a lot of uncertainty on how it exactly proceeded and when, but it is within this period that we observe the most distant quasars that we know today. So between redshifts of 6 to 7.5 roughly, which is about 13 billion light years away from us, we observe the most distant quasars at the moment. And these very distant quasars already host supermassive black holes with a billion solar masses in their center. And because they host these supermassive black holes, it's accreting supermassive black holes, they're incredibly bright. So actually those quasars are the most luminous, non-transient objects that we know in the universe. And therefore they're the ideal laboratory to actually study these really early evolutionary phases. But of course, despite their brightness, they're very, very far away from us. And so by the time their light reaches Earth, they're actually really faint. And so we need some of the largest telescopes that we have available at the moment to study these very distant quasars. And I'm just going to show you some of the telescopes that we've been using recently, briefly. So the top three images here are the largest optical and infrared telescopes that we currently have, located in Hawaii, and those two are in the Atacama Desert in Chile. All of them have mirrors between 8 to 10 meters in diameter. So at the moment, at least, they're the largest ones that we have. And then the bottom two here are radio or submillimeter telescopes in the French Alps and also in the Atacama Desert. And so it's these telescopes that we use to study the light that the quasars emit. And so how does the light look like? Well, at least in the UV and optical rest frame wavelength regime, the quasar light consists of a fairly flat continuum emission that comes from the emission around the accretion disk around the black hole. And on top of that, there's these broad emission lines, which are from the so-called broad line region, which are gas clouds orbiting the black hole. And the most prominent of those lines is the Lyman alpha line here. But this is not how we observe the quasar. The light, there we go, has to travel through the universe. And while the light travels towards us, two things happen. Well, first, the light becomes redshifted, of course, due to the expansion of the universe. But the other thing that happens is that part of the light becomes absorbed whenever it passes through the cosmic web, for instance, or through clouds that contain, dense clouds that contain trace amounts of neutral hydrogen. And so, the neutral hydrogen absorbs part of the incoming light, and it creates this dense pattern of absorption lines, which is called the Lyman series forest, because it's mostly hydrogen in intergalactic gas. But because we observe these quasars at redshift 6 and beyond, so really at the earliest times that we can, these quasars look more like this. So these are 30 redshift 6 and beyond quasars, sorted by redshift, and you can see how there's almost no flux bluebirds of the Lyman alpha emission line in these cases, because we're approaching the epoch of reionization, we're peering deeper into the beginning of the universe, so there's more neutral gas, and that completely absorbs everything bluebirds of this Lyman alpha emission line. All right, so these are the spectra that we have available now to study the growth of the supermassive black holes that are located in the center of these objects. And before we dive in, I just wanna briefly summarize the problem that we're trying to solve. So we know that there are these supermassive black holes with billions of solar masses in size in the center of quasars, and they must have started growing from some smaller black hole that then accreted mass, like the gas and dust and stars and so on, to become more massive. And all of this has to happen during the active quasar phases, because we established that the emission of quasar light and the buildup of the black hole is concomitant. And it has to happen in less than 800 million years, because that's the age of the universe when we observe the first quasars. So the unknown parameters in this picture that we need to understand are really what's the initial mass of the black hole seeds by the time basically they start growing. So how much mass do we actually have to accrete in the first place? What's the mass accretion rate? So how much mass can we accrete in a given amount of time? And then maybe a less obvious parameter is the lifetime of quasars. So how much time do these galaxies spend in this active luminous quasar phase? We know it has to be something less than 800 million years, but presumably it's less than that, because these black holes didn't start growing at the Big Bang. All right. So in the standard picture of black hole growth, the rest mass energy of the accreted mass is divided between radiation and black hole growth. And this division is via the radiative efficiency, which is this epsilon here. And it implies basically that the emission of quasar light is happening at the same time as the black hole is being built up. And so this equation basically just shows that the luminosity of the gas that's being accreted onto black hole is proportional to the accreted black hole mass, and this proportionality constant is the radiative efficiency. And this is nothing else than the consequence out of the Sultan argument I showed you earlier in the talk. And so the black hole accretes the non-radiated away component. So if you put those equations together, you get that the black hole grows exponentially during the lifetime of the quasar, starting from some initial black hole seed. And the characteristic time scale on which this black hole growth is happening is the so-called Salpeter E-folding time, which is about 45 mega years if you make standard assumptions about radiative efficiency and assume that the quasars accrete at the theoretical maximum, or shine at the theoretical maximum limit, which is adding some luminosity. And it requires about 16 E-folding times to grow a supermassive black hole from a stellar remnant black hole seed to like the billion solar mass black holes. So this is a really, really long time.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please, go ahead.
So is that epsilon of 0.1 based off of, you know, some sort of observation, or is that based off of some kind of like theoretical estimates?
Yeah, so good point. It's both, basically. So it comes, you can calculate about from thin accretion disk models. It goes in there and you can get it out. You can also, it's also observationally determined via the Sultan argument, basically, for lower redshift. So at lower redshift, we know that this theoretical value from accretion disk models of 10% works, basically, with the observations.
But if that number were like 5%, you're saying that the Sultan argument would break down when we look at like, you know, low redshift quasars? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so there is some room. So depending, it's also in the models, it's dependent on the spin of the black hole. So actually, if you have, it goes from 5 to 40% roughly. So 10% is just like a fiducial value. It wouldn't, so within that room, it doesn't break down, but what I'm going to argue is that we need like two or three orders of magnitude difference here, and then it breaks down. But at these higher redshifts, we will need something that's very, very different.
Okay, great, thanks.
I'll come to there in a minute. But okay, so this is just a very simple picture of the black hole growth, and in reality, this is probably not quite as simple, because it also, for instance, requires a constant amount of fueling material and so on. But if we just assume this is true for the moment and look at some of the most distant quasars that we know to date, they all host roughly like these billion solar mass black holes. Here are just three examples that I put here, but just so these are, yeah, three quasars at redshift 6 to 7.5. But we know at the moment more than 200 quasars at redshift 6 and beyond. So this could actually be populated a lot more. If we make these standard assumptions for the radiative efficiency, we can calculate back what the black hole seed must have been by the time these quasars started growing. And so I put in here these two gray bands, which show just two models for how these black hole seeds could have formed. There's several more, but these two basically span the parameter range a little bit. And the easiest or the most standard model, I guess, is that these initial black hole seeds come from remnants from the first generation of stars, these population 3 stars that are believed to be more massive than the stars we observe today. And so if you're optimistic, they provide black hole seeds between 100 to 1,000 solar masses. But then there's other theories that could that are not as well established. But for instance, the collapse of a gas cloud, the direct collapse of a gas cloud, could also lead to a black hole seed if you have very special physical conditions. That, for instance, the gas cloud doesn't fragment and form stars and so on. So you need some very special conditions. This is the reason why this is still a bit debated, but if this mechanism exists, it could provide more massive initial black hole seeds. And you can see that if we make these standard assumptions with the black hole grays, like the POP3 remnant stars is already like a little bit in tension. It gets worse if we change the radiative efficiency to being larger, so more of the accreted mass would be radiated away, less would end up on the black hole. If you change it the other way, you can solve some of this discrepancy. However, there's another parameter, which is the lifetime, which is here, the lifetime to quasars. So how long do these quasars spend in the galaxy spend in this quasar state? How long do these luminous quasar phases last? And at the same time, how much time do these black holes have to grow? And you can see that in all of those is here colored. If you want to go down to like these black hole seeds of 10 to 3 solar masses or so on, you need already very, very long lifetimes. And if we just reduce this to 10 to the 8 years, for instance, which I'm going to show you is a more realistic value for the lifetime of quasars, or even 10 to the 7, then we're back and we have an issue again here with this very simple model for the black hole growth. All right, so this is just a very basic model, which I said in reality, probably this is not how it works. And so one very important parameter that we need to know to understand how these supermassive black holes can grow is this lifetime of quasars. How long do these quasars have shine and emit radiation at the same time grow the black hole? Turns out measuring quasar lifetimes is actually really difficult. We have this idea of the Salpeter time that gives you a rough theoretical estimate, but actually measuring these lifetimes is very difficult. There are a few estimates in the literature from quasar clustering studies, but that usually only works at lower redshifts because you need a lot of those quasars and they become fainter, of course, the higher you go. And so so actually measuring these lifetimes is actually very difficult. And so in the last few years, my collaborators and me, we have developed a new method to actually try to figure out how long do these quasars actually shine? What's the lifetime of these objects? And the idea of this new method is the following. If you know that these quasars emit copious amounts of radiation, and so they ionize its surroundings and they create a bubble of ionized gas around them. And so the longer the quasar shines, the larger this bubble of ionized gas. And at the same time, at these very high redshift, if you have ionized gas, it absorbs less of the incoming flux than neutral gas. And so what happens is that you observe this region of enhanced transmitted flux in the vicinity of the quasar, which is called the proximity zone. And that gives you an idea of how long these quasars have been shining. And to be a bit more quantitative, we run one-dimensional radio transit simulation in post-processing on the cosmological hydrodynamical simulation. And I'm just showing you one skewer through that simulation at the moment. This is for a quasar at redshift 6. The top panel shows a neutral gas fraction as a function of distance from the quasar. Quasar's here. And the bottom panel shows you the spectrum of the quasar as we were to observe it. The gray dashed line is the continuum emission from the quasar, but because this is at redshift 6 and we have still a high fraction of neutral gas, most of the flux is absorbed. And so what you would actually observe is this black line. And so if we now turn on the quasar, there we go, you can see the lifetime in this blue box here. You can see how the quasar starts to ionize its surroundings. It creates this bubble of ionized gas around it. The neutral gas fraction in the vicinity of the quasar decreases. And at the same time, we observe more and more of the trends of the flux that is being emitted by the quasar, because more and more of the flux can now be transmitted through the intergalactic medium and actually reach our telescopes on Earth. And so if we can measure, or if we can have an idea of how much transmitted flux there's in the vicinity of these quasars, we can get in turn an idea about the lifetime of these objects. And so that's what we did. And if we look at these along many, many different sidelines, not just one, you get this dependency. So this is the proximity zone here on the y-axis as a function of the lifetime of the quasar. And the proximity zone basically is our attempt to measure how much transmitted flux there is in the vicinity of these quasars. And it's basically a distance from the quasar at which there's still significant transmitted flux visible.
What parameters besides this lifetime affect this proximity zone? Like the density of the gas, I would think, would also matter, you know?
So the density is part of the simulation. So the range of density that you find around the quasars is basically encapsulated in the width of this distribution. So the cosmic variance, basically. We also have a fairly good handle on how dense-ish, fairly good handle, how dense the environment of quasars are. And the way we measure these proximity zones is really, it's a distance measure for a distance from the quasar to the last significant transmitted flux spike, basically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, does it also depend on other things? Like, so in your previous slide, I guess, so if you go back to that, so before the quasar turned on, this neutral gas fraction initially was at some number, like kind of the -4.
Right.
So if you change that, does that change then this answer you get?
Yeah, that definitely changes. That's a good point. At least the quasars that we look at are all at redshift 6-ish, so they all have a similar neutral gas fraction. But if you move to these higher redshift quasars, like 7 and beyond, the neutral gas fraction increases quite significantly. You can still apply our method, but you then have degeneracies between the neutral gas fraction and lifetime. And so we did that as well. I can show you slides later but just because we don't have many quasars yet at very high redshifts, most of these we can assume that the neutral gas fraction is fairly low, but we have calculated the degeneracy, or like how we can marginalize out over the neutral gas fraction, basically. I think I can show you, but I don't. There we go. I think. Okay, so basically this is the same idea. I'll go back in a second, but this is the same idea for a quasar redshift 7 or 7.5. And the idea here is, I don't know whether you guys can see the lifetime. Somehow my face is blocking it. at least for me. But the lifetime is on the top right here. Mm-hmm. And because it's more neutral around it, you get this like damping wing from the neutral IgM. And so if you turn on the quasar in a very neutral IgM, you can see that it first takes a while to reduce the damping wing, and then you get the proximity zone. So you can both get a handle on the neutral gas fraction and the proximity zone at the same time, and the lifetime at the same time.
Oh, I see. I see. Well, that's interesting. Wow. Okay, thanks.
All right, now I have to find... All right, cool. So going back to this picture here, now I have to move. This is at redshift 6 now, so where we assume that the IgM is neutral, or mostly has a low neutral gas fraction, mostly ionized actually. And so this is the dependency that we get between the proximity zone and the quasar lifetime. And you can see that it increases for very low lifetimes. So you see this increase here, and then it reaches, it plateaus once the intergalactic gas reaches ionization equilibrium with the quasar's radiation. So that's when it plateaus. And then we see an increase again for fairly long lifetimes, which is due to the reionization of helium in the intergalactic medium. And so we can use this dependency now to study the lifetime of quasars. And here's just one example where we measure the proximity zone in a quasar at redshift 6. You can see the proximity zone here is indicated by these reddish lines. In this case, it's a fairly small proximity zone of only like 2 proper megaparsec. If we see where it falls here in the middle panel, you can already see it predicts a fairly short lifetime. And this is the posterior probability distribution for the quasar lifetime of this particular object. And in this case, it only predicts about 10,000, a lifetime of about only 10,000 years or less, which is very short. But we did this for a whole range of quasar spectra, and most of them show a much longer lifetime, but there are some like this one that show these very, very short lifetimes. All right,
so this number, we should interpret this as like the amount of time that ionizing photons have been getting out from the black hole?
Right. It's the time since the quasar turned on, basically. So the time since, well, the quasar turned on since the accretion onto the black hole has started. And
well, but that's assuming that all the light gets out, right? You know, but if there was like some sort of like obscuration or something near the black hole preventing the light from getting out, then that would artificially make this lifetime of yours short, right?
Yeah, we need the UV radiation coming out. I'll come back to that point in about 3 slides.
Okay, great.
All right. I want to briefly put those measurements into context with other measurements that exist in the literature. So here we have the lifetime as a function of redshift. So for different quasars at different redshifts, this theoretical idea that from the Salpeter time that we need about 16 Salpeter times to grow a billion solar mass black hole is also indicated here. And you can see that actually every measurement that we have is in tension with this theoretical estimate. And it gets into at these very high redshift, you have a tension with the age of the universe. And these are all the estimates that my collaborators and me have been conducted over the last few years for quasars at these redshifts. I just want to point, I think there's 3 things to take away from this plot. The first one is that for the first time, we can actually consistently measure lifetimes at very high redshift, which was probably previously not or in very exceptional cases possible. The average lifetime across cosmic time really seems to be somewhere between like 10 to 6 or 10 to 7 maybe years. And we have a population, we find a population of very, very young quasars, one of them I showed you before, which only has like about 1,000, maybe 10,000 years at the time that we observe it. And we estimate that it's about 5 to 10%. So a significant fraction of the quasar population at large that show these very short lifetimes. Before moving on and going to the point of what could be going on, I just want to point out one more measurement, because that's done by a student of mine. And I want to just highlight his work briefly. He has done really excellent work here. And what we did was we stacked, I think about 20 quasispectra at redshift 6 to get like an average transmission profile. And from the average transmission profile, we could get basically an effective lifetime of these high redshift quasars. These are just our models again. And he gets also about 10 to 6 or so years. So even for an ensemble of quasars, not only for individual ones, we get a very short lifetime. Just to show quickly how that, what that does to this model, this was already being very positive about the radiative efficiency, assuming lifetimes throughout the whole age of the universe. If we remove it to 10 to 8, 10 to 7, or 10 to the 6 years, there's no time for these black holes to grow. And so the standard model clearly doesn't work really well with our measurements. And so there's a few things that we thought could be going on. The first one is, well, maybe we have evidence for very massive initial seeds. I showed you that on the previous slide. Even if you go to the most optimistic theories for how massive these black holes can be, it can loosen the tension a little bit that we observe, but we still can't grow a billion solar mass black hole, even if the black hole seeds is like 10 to the 6 solar masses, if we have really those short lifetimes. Another option is that we have flickering quasar light curves, meaning there could be like multiple epochs of black hole growth. And this proximity design measurement is only sensitive to the last on time. So if we had some previous growth episodes, we would not see it. However, we did look into this, and there's, I think, several arguments that make us believe that it would loosen tension again between the discrepancy between the lifetime that we need and the lifetimes that we observe, but it can't solve the whole issue. We could have UV obscured quasar growth. That is a very valid option, so that we are only sensitive to the UV radiation if the UV radiation is like obscured. If there's some like dust enshrouded initial stages of the growth or something, we would not be able to see those objects. Or we could have very, very, very radiatively inefficient accretion. And so in especially those last two points, we believe are actually very valid, very reasonable solutions, or the most likely explanations for how we can modify these black hole growth models to explain our measurements. And go ahead.
Flickering, you think, though, is not important, though, huh? Like, so if you turn off the quasar, you know, so how long does it take for the ionized fraction to go back to like the normal value?
Yeah, not very long, roughly like 10 to 4 years. So roughly the time that it needs to go in ionization equilibrium at redshift 6. Because why it goes fairly fast is because usually the recombination timescale of hydrogen is very, very long, but we don't have to recombine very much because the neutral gas fraction at redshift 6 is already only 10 to the minus 4. So we really only have to recombine from 10 to minus 5 to 10 to minus 4 or something to make the proximity zone go away. So at redshift 6, we're definitely not sensitive at all to any previous estimates. The reason, I think now I have to go back to what I quickly showed you earlier, the reason why we still think it doesn't matter, or if it matters, it can't explain the whole, it's not that it doesn't matter, if it matters, it doesn't explain the whole discrepancy that we observe, are twofold. So the first one is what I showed you here before, namely that if you go to very high redshift, you have these neutral gas fraction of 10, 20, like 30%. So you observe these this damping wing. And in order to get rid of this damping wing, so if the quasar would turn off now again, you would have to recombine to almost unity. And this is like longer than the Hubble time at these redshifts. So if we observe these quasars that have a damping wing, we can get an integrated constraint on how many UV photons ever escape from the quasar into the intergalactic medium. And so if we do this for, like, this is just two examples that a collaborator of mine, Fred Davies, has measured. For two redshift 7 quasars, you can see there's these damping wings. And so this gives us basically an integrated constraint on how many UV photons have left. And so even if there were previous times, we would catch it. That's one point why we, probably the best argument why the flickering can't account for the whole discrepancy, but loosen attention. Another one is that we actually model those flickering quasar light curves and at redshift 6 again now and compare the distribution of the of proximity zones that you would get to the distribution that we measure. And we, at least in the parameter space that we did explore, it seems like a simple light bulb model where you just turn on is more consistent with our proximity zones than if you have variations. But we have not yet explored the whole parameter space of how long you turn it on, how long you turn it off, and whether that could fit. But in any case, let me go back.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Mostly. Yeah, like, I have to think some more about it, I guess. I think so.
Okay. Well, we can come back to this. In the last bit, I want to show you...
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Yes. How much would you have to increase the age of the universe from 13.8 billion years to accommodate these short lifetimes and growth?
That's a good question. Well, I think if our measurements are correct, they're like very short, right? So it doesn't really matter how long before the universe was on. I think if you want to have the standard picture and you have to make the age of the universe only marginally like longer. So if we go back to this figure, so in this standard, very simple exponential growth model, it takes 16 E folding times to grow the black hole. And you get into tension with this at redshift 7 or so, but there's also uncertainties on the black hole masses. So
there are various models of the universe beginning, the bounce models, models with extended lifetimes, mirror universes, take your pick.
Yeah, so I don't know those models, but I think from this figure, if our measurements are correct, even if the age of the universe would be longer, it wouldn't solve anything really. Does that make sense?
Sorry, why is this? Would it make a difference?
So what we measure is how long these quasars have been shining and like when they started turning on, when the accretion onto the black hole started. And we are significantly like orders of magnitude shorter than what we assume, what the theoretical model predicts, or the simple theoretical models predict, and also what the age of the universe is. So the simple theoretical model starts to be in giving problems with the age of the universe at high redshift. But our measurements are so far away from this theoretical model that the universe is not the problem. We have other problems.
So it's the quasar, it's the growth is the problem, not the universe itself.
The universe is not the problem, not our problem, but the growth, yeah. So the life, yes. So if the universe is older, it would unfortunately, I mean, it might solve the issue in the sense that maybe you could form more massive black hole seeds before you even start accreting matter onto them, but I don't think that's, I don't know whether that would solve it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, Dave, because we have this issue with direction collapse and supernova collapse and pulsation pair instability of helium cores, and et cetera, et cetera. This is becoming more of a problem as we keep increasing the size of the black hole masses. Where do they come from?
That's a good question. Okay, in the last few minutes, I would like to show you how we think we can actually distinguish between these different scenarios, because we do have just the degeneracy and the one-dimensional measurement of the proximity zone, but we think that we can actually figure out how to break this degeneracy by mapping out the quasi's light echo into two or more dimensions. And so this is just a very simple sketch of how one idea, how we think we can map out the quasi's light echo. I mentioned on the one hand, we could have radiatively inefficient accretion that it could explain the rapid growth of these black holes. If that was the case, we could have a quiescent galaxy 10 to the 4 or 5 years before our observations, then accretion onto a black hole started and we have a quasar that starts to emit this ionizing radiation. On the other hand, we could have highly obscured quasar growth where the inner region of the black hole is obscured at least along our line of sight. And that would mean that like 10 to the 4 or 5 years before we observe the quasars, our line of sight would have been blocked through the quasar's through some like obscuring medium. In both cases, we would observe a very small proximity zone for these objects, but the extended nebular emission in different directions, in the perpendicular direction to our line of sight, it would be different. It would be more extended if the quasars have been shining for longer in unobscured directions. Whereas if it was actually growing very fast, we would see only a small extended emission. And that's something that we believe we can actually measure with the upcoming James Webb Space Telescope. We would, if we observe the surface brightness profile of the nebula emission around these objects, we expect it to be more extended if obscuration is causing us to measure very short UV luminous lifetimes, basically. Whereas it would be truncated if the quasar has actually just turned on and is very young. In both cases would actually be quite interesting. In the one case, we would predict that there is a large fraction of obscured quasars in the high redshift universe that we don't know, that we haven't found yet. And a large fraction, I mean roughly 50 to 1. That is what we need to explain the whole black hole growth, but only with obscuration. On the other hand, if these quasars are actually young, if they have actually just turned on, we have evidence for relative inefficient accretion, which would also be really interesting. And we have these, at least the population of very young quasars would mean that the UV luminous radiation has actually just turned on recently. And so they are ideal probes to now study triggering and feedback mechanisms of supermassive black holes. We have some reason to believe that this latter, the radiative inefficient accretion, is actually what's going on. Some very tentative preliminary results is that we looked at 30 quasars with MUSE, with the IFU, the integral field unit, on the very large telescope. And what you do is like you look at the quasar, you subtract the point spread function, what remains is the extended emission. And this is just an example here. And we have three quasars in the data set that show these very short proximity zones, and they have no extended emission at all. However, these are very shallow observations, so we could just be below the surface brightness limit. And so in the future, we would like to do this with James Webb, where we can have higher spatial resolution, so we can go closer to the black hole and probe smaller distances from the quasar, basically. And we have other lines available in Lyman Alpha. We have a whole range of infrared lines that are more stable than Lyman Alpha. If this is really accounting for the whole black hole growth, we can calculate what radiative efficiency we would need to grow the black hole in only a short amount of time. And these are for two rich of seven quasars. Again, this are the posterior probability distribution of the radiative efficiency. And this blue shaded line here, shaded region, is what the fiducial thin accretion disk models give, and it's roughly about 10%, but there's some spread through to like spins and so on. But we can actually exclude these theoretical models at very high significance, at least for these very high redshift quasars. So something must change in the very high redshift universe. Either we have very relatively inefficient accretion in high redshift quasars, or we have a very high fraction of obscured quasars. And neither of that is consistent with what the lower redshift universe says. So there must be some like change between redshift 6 and redshift 3, either in the obscuration or in the radiative efficiency. And with this, I just want to briefly summarize. I show you that we have a new method to constrain lifetimes by looking at the proximity zones, so the regions of enhanced transmitted flux in the quasar spectrum. We find very, very short lifetimes consistently over the whole redshift range where we did this, which pose significant challenges on the simple black hole formation models. And so something has to be altered at high redshift, at least to incorporate our results. And we think that we can figure out or get more constraints on how these black holes, supermassive black holes, can grow so rapidly by mapping out the light eco of the quasar. And that's something to do for the future. So thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks so much, Christina, for this beautiful talk. We already had quite a number of questions during the talk. Do we have any more? So just raise your hand and then, Anna, please go ahead.
Hi, I was just kind of curious. You give all these possibilities that could address this issue, but like, are they all mutually exclusive, or could it be some combination?
It could be definitely some combination of it. So it could definitely, but we still need one of those two major ones, I think, to contribute significantly. Both of those, the initial seeds, massive seeds, and like turning on and off, having multiple epochs of black hole growth, cannot solve it all. So we need to have some kind of combination, but yeah.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah, Jen, please.
Yeah. If the radiation inefficient accretion explains the low quasar lifetime, is it still consistent with Sultan's argument? That means the total integrated emission is roughly reflect the total mass of supermassive black hole.
Yeah, so the Sultan argument has been shown to be consistent with the rate of efficiency of 10% at redshifts like between like 0 to 4, basically. And so either that, so if we change the radiative efficiency throughout the whole cosmic time, then the Sultan argument would break down, there's no evidence that it would at the moment, but it could, it's a possibility that the measurements are wrong. But assuming that Sultan argument is right and we have a radiative efficiency of about 10%, which was what the models say, which is what the observations say, then there has to change something. We have to have some change to redshift 6. Something has to become more inefficient in the higher universe, high redshift universe.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I actually also had another question. So I was just wondering about this obscuration scenario. So I mean, if we're talking about quasars, we are essentially looking into the jet, so essentially on axis, right? So wouldn't one think that essentially if there's any obscuration in that direction, that sort of the jet would get rid of that for us? Or say in other words, is there anything known about a sort of UV obscuration, for example, in AGN, where we're not looking sort of on axis, but we have a sort of different observer angle and we're sort of probing different sort of parts of this accretion geometry?
Yeah. So there's two thoughts about that. So our measurements are of the lifetime are independent on the geometry in the sense that the size of the proximity zone is not only dependent on the lifetime, but also, of course, on the luminosity of the quasar. So we have to normalize by the luminosity of the quasar. If you have a brighter quasar in the first place, also the proximity zone, the ionized bubble is larger. So there's some dependency on that we take out. And so we're self-consistent in the way that like we measure the luminosity along our sight line. So if the quasar would be brighter or less bright in a different direction, we take it into account. So the lifetime should not matter on that. Regarding whether simply the geometry can account for the whole obscuration effects, I think the answer is no, even though I have to think about it. But the reason is that at lower redshift, we know roughly what the obscuration fraction is, and we can observe, for instance, obscured quasars, where the central region is obscured. And so the estimate from lower redshifts, where you also, of course, have the geometric effects, is about that 50% is obscured and 50% is not. So assuming that there's still... That should take geometric effects into account. So if that's still the same at redshift 6, we definitely need more obscured quasars.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Any more questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Is it possible there's a primordial formation explanation?
Yeah, good question. It is the possibility that these initial seeds could form from primordial black holes. I don't think people speak about primordial black holes in the sense that they can form seeds of already like 10 to the 8 or so solar masses. My understanding of primordial black holes, but I'm no expert in no way, is that if they exist, the range of masses that they predict is roughly consistent with the range of masses that would be predicted by these direct collapse black holes. So the 10 to the 6 solar mass like limit, basically, like this region, the 10 to the 6 solar mass black holes heat seem to be the upper limit for direct collapse. There's also something called like dark stars that could also form these black hole initial black hole seeds, and all of those seem to have a limit, like predict a maximum of 10 to 6 solar masses. And my understanding is that this is the same for primordial black holes, but I might be mistaken.
Yeah, the observational constraints on primordial black holes are quite severe, actually. Yeah.
So I spoke to Alan Guth at MIT about this, and he said he would look into it. But haven't heard from him since.
Okay, we have another question from Pablo.
Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for your talk, Christina. It was really interesting. I just have a very naive question. Would it help at all to fold in into, you know, the growth of the black hole, maybe another black hole that merges So even if you just have the one, I can imagine that at late stages, if it has a similar growing path and it merges, then you reduce your time by half, and that would make a huge difference. Or if you just imagine that you have some merger at early times, perhaps you can start with larger seeds, or, I mean, I'm not really sure of the details, but yeah.
Yeah, so you need really the major mergers to contribute significantly, right? To have like a factor of two in a major merger. So there has been, let me see whether I find it, there have been work by Fabio Pacucci and Avi Loeb earlier this year, where they looked at which redshift and black hole mass regions are merger dominated and accretion dominated. And you can see that during most of the cosmic time, you really have accretion dominated black hole growth, which is again actually consistent with the Solturn argument, because the Solturn argument said that if you take the quasi-luminosity function, so the whole integrated emission over quasars, it's consistent with the black hole, the accreted mass on black holes today. So you really need accretion to make the Solturn argument work. Again, this could break, but from this work, you can see that like only at the very low mass end and at very high redshift, and at the very high mass but the very low redshift, mergers dominate significantly. So again, we can have some contribution, but it won't solve the whole issue.
So are we concerned about factors of two or three or orders of magnitude?
We're concerned about orders of magnitude. That's why don't matter too much.
That's bad news.
That is bad news. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, any more questions? I actually had one last question. So about these radiative inefficient, this radiative inefficient scenario. So what's exactly the idea behind this? So essentially you have just a thick disk accretion where essentially you just eject all the thermal energy into the black hole and sort of none of that really gets radiated away. And the other thing is I was wondering about magnetic flux actually. So this is something that plays a role in long GRBs as well, where this is still an open question. Namely, like the question how much magnetic flux you can actually push onto the black hole. And so there could be, for example, I could see that there may be epochs in which sort of there's too much magnetic flux onto the black hole and you get this magnetically arrested disk, so these so-called mad disks. And so that would definitely sort of truncate the emission from the jet. I'm not entirely sure what it would do to the UV radiation, but I don't know if something along these lines is being thought of in this context.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of people trying to run these magnetohydrodynamic simulations of black hole growths and trying to figure out what are reasonable, especially if you add magnetic fields, which of course matter, and how the structure of the accretion disk would look like if you had these radiatively inefficient disks, accretion disks. And so, again, I'm no expert, but in this, from my understanding, is that they are working on like figuring out how far you can push these radiative efficiency. And I think they've gotten to like 1%, but so far, to my knowledge, there are not many that can explain radiative efficiencies of like 0.1%, especially over a prolonged time period.
I see. Okay, thanks. Any last questions? This is the last chance. Okay, well, if not, then let's thank Christina again for this wonderful talk. Thanks a lot for presenting here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you, Christina.
Thank you.